So cosmological non-constant is something Nyayesh did a while ago. This has nothing to do with that. So to avoid confusion with that, let me talk about the cosmological inconstant. Nyayesh already told me that sounds like incontinent, which is not. So you can't win, basically. And what I'm going to talk about is essentially the result of three generations of papers, at least. This must be one of the first few occasions in which the classical theory was guessed from the quantum theory, and not the opposite way around. And this all started off with me, Stefan, and Lee coming up with really crazy stuff, you know, trying to do away with a number of problems in quantum cosmology. And somehow, Lee guessed the classical theory, and I will tell you mainly about the cosmological implications of the classical theory, but in two different incarnations, which are connected and meshed in a way which I'm not totally sure about. Okay? So, it's all very clear. Ultimately, I guess we're trying to solve the cosmological constant problem. That's a big word. As you know, the troubles with the cosmological constant are endless. Everyone has a different slant on it. It's a very multifaceted problem. As a cosmologist, the problem for me is a fine-tuning issue due to the fact that the universe expands, everything else dilutes. The cosmological constant, as the name indicates, doesn't dilute. Therefore, you have to be very careful to avoid domination by lambda. And this was not obviously alleviated, in fact, was aggravated by the recent evidence the universe is accelerating. Should the acceleration of the universe, in fact, be the result of the cosmological constant? So, you know, this is, I'm not going to spend much time, I'm not going to dwell on this for very long. I'm pretty sure you all know this problem. The problem gets even worse from the other angles. In high energy physics, there are a number of issues with vacuum energy and so on. It's a complete pain of a problem, undoubtedly. The cosmological constant is as old as the Einstein's equations. That's one thing you should know. And it was first noted as an option right at the time Einstein was setting up the equations. So this is the kind of thing, if you've ever taught relativity or been in a relativity course, you know, you go through a lot of pain explaining what is the Einstein tensor. And then you realize there is something much simpler you can add, which is just linear in the metric, and that's the cosmological constant. So this is how things first appeared, and let me emphasize that usually the Einstein equations are derived in the second-order formalism, so-called second-order formalism, because the equations are second-order, the metric is the main variable, and the connection is just a slave to the metric, it's the Christoffel connection. So this kind of formalism is very nice, but in a way precludes torsion, which is going to be a major issue in this talk, a major character in this play. So there's two things which make the connection compatible with the metric, metricity and torsion-free conditions, and they're basically built into the formalism, okay? So it's an important point to make right at the start, and this is in part the reason why the name constant is not wasted. It's, lambda is rightly called a constant. So just take the Einstein equations. Let's imagine we're in vacuum to begin with. So just take a gradient of the Einstein equations. There are these identities, which are geometrical identities and must be valid in any theory, called the Bianchi identities. This is the metricity condition, which the Christoffel connection satisfies. So this immediately gives you the fact that lambda must be a constant. And this is true with matter as well. If matter is conserved, and you can prove that matter is conserved, the only caveat here is that, of course, there could be some kind of interchange of energy between lambda and matter, that's not relevant for this talk. Okay, so one slide reason for why lambda is a constant. To go back to the historical foundations, well, as you know, it's also called cosmological because it only has effects on cosmological scales. When Einstein proposed these equations, there was no evidence for anything other than a static universe, and this was a quick way to make the universe static instead of expanding. So clearly when Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding, well, I think there's been some controversy about whether this quote is genuine or not. John Wheeler apparently said he did hear that was the biggest blunder of my life. But you know, once the cat is among the pigeons, there's very little you can do, so lambda's initial motivation is gone. But as I said in my first slide, well, now it's very difficult to put the genie back in the bottle, and now we have this problem. Why is the cosmological constant not dominating the universe? Why is it not infinite? Why is it what it is? So essentially, we revisited these issues. It was a very important thing we tried to do. We tried to revisit the argument, but using the Cartan reformulation of gravity. So recall that it is possible to formulate GR as a gauge theory, but then the gauge field is the connection. So the workhorse of the theory is not the metric, but it's the connection to begin with. And you can look at the Riemann tensor as the field strength of this gauge field, so this connection. So this is something which was proposed by Cartan a long time ago, was picked up by various people, including Tom Kibble, and he goes into things like loop quantum gravity and so on, because it makes gravity look like a gauge theory very nicely, with this odd fact that there is a connection, there is a metric field as well as the connection, the tetrad. But it's quite different what happens. So in the end, on shell, you end up with the same theory. But in fact, what happens is that you have, with some conditions, you have this field equation, which then enforces the torsion to be zero, which then makes sure that the connection is actually the Christoffel connection. But this doesn't need to be true in general. So the torsion does not need to be true. It is, happens to be true with some conditions about invertibility, et cetera, et cetera. And typically, in the absence of spinners, we're going to see here a bunch of cases in which varying lambda and torsion are going to come together. So this is exactly the main point I'd like you to take away. Then we'll make this more complicated as the talk goes on. So let's revisit the argument for the constancy of lambda. This is the Einstein equations in these formulas. So let's imagine first there's no matter, like I did before. And a solution is this thing called the self-dual solution. So you can see this guy equals a third of this guy solves the equations. The Bianchi identities in this formalism are just the statement that dr is zero. So let's take, as we did before, a derivative of the Einstein equations in this form. Well, if this is zero, now it is possible to have a varying lambda as long as the derivative of the tetrad is not zero, if there is torsion. So in fact, what we find is at this very basic level, and this will be complicated later on, if there is torsion to this tune, then the Bianchi identities and the varying lambda can coexist. This was the first remark. It's quite an interesting remark. Let's see where this takes us. So this is completely classical. As I warned you, that's not where we started. But this is where we finished when we tried to do the classical theory. OK, so the question now is, what kind of theory will generate distortion? A major theme in this collaboration was to be not like quintessence. So let's not be cosmologists. Let's not be these people who just invent 15 parameters and then they fit all the data with 15 parameters and they say, we've done a great job. No. So let's try and do something exactly the opposite, something which maybe is ruled out, but at least we die, you know, fighting. Let's try not to put any free parameters in the theory. And to avoid an ungainly proliferation of free parameters, we just use some kind of principles. These are two formulations. They're not quite equivalent. They can be useful and related. So you can have something like the quasi-topological principle. Let's just introduce new terms in lambda which are topological when lambda is a constant. It's quite a nice way that cut across a lot of complications. Something which spells out this more is basically, let's make sure we don't go beyond quadratic in the curvature. Let's leave the standard Einstein equations unmodified. Let's make sure we have something like the Palatini action or the Holst action as a starting point. And then typically, let's use this duality, which is clearly very important in the constant lambda theory. Let's keep this duality of the pure gravitational action. So these two things, in a way, in a funny way, they're not exactly equivalent. But you know, this thing can be used as some kind of heuristics, if you want, or not. Anyways, just to give you some ideas which have the benefit that we don't introduce 25 parameters. In fact, we're going to be reducing the number of parameters in the theory instead of increasing the number of parameters in the theory. So this is guesswork. Can we actually guess the theory? It's enough, in fact, to guess the theory, because this duality doesn't care about whether lambda is a constant or not. So what you can do is go to the Palatini formulation, the Palatini action, which is this one here, and just see if you can turn this guy invariant under this duality. And this was like the first step, which Lee used. And in fact, this is very prolific. This is a very fruitful way to go around it. go about it, because what you find is that this completely defines, this guy is already invariant under that duality, this guy is not invariant. To make this invariant, you end up with a term, which is the Euler term, with a prefactor that's completely fixed. So this 1 over lambda you could have guessed using dimensional analysis. The minus 3 halves you couldn't, you just get it fixed, and that's it, end of the story. So very interesting, and this is the way in which you can say you have one fewer parameter than relativity, because here lambda is not a constant, right? Lambda here, in relativity, lambda is a constant, here lambda is a field, and we haven't introduced any new parameters. So if anything, you have one fewer parameter than in standard general relativity. And famous last words, this would be amazing if this actually worked, and it doesn't work, okay? But at least you start by doing the thing, which is the most honest to God, to kind of generalize a theory which has constant lambda to something which does not have a constant lambda. So it's pretty simple. All you've allowed is to have relativity seen as a gauge field and torsion to be a possible term, and you find that, in fact, this topological, quasi-topological term is the only thing you need to add, and it's fully fixed. Okay, so what are the field equations? By construction, your Einstein equations are not modified. You end up with two new arrivals, one which comes from the torsion equation, which you obtain by varying with respect to the connection. You end up with this expression here. This is usually zero. No, it isn't zero. And then by varying with respect to lambda, you end up with this guy there. And yes, indeed, you find that this thing does the job. I can change the slide. So let's go to vacuum first. You find that indeed, this guy continues to solve, the self-dual condition continues to solve the Einstein equations. But if you plug this inside this guy here, then the torsion is the thing which the Bianchi identity seems to require, okay? So this kind of action does indeed do the job of where we started from. Now, the funny thing, which was a surprise to us, is of course lambda squared equals lambda squared is the equation that comes from varying lambda. So funnily enough, lambda is not specified by the field equation. So let me pause here a bit. I'm gonna tell, the rest of the talk is about this. We should be able to kind of guess what's coming. Let me give away the game in a way. So every time you see something which is not defined by the field equations, it's clear there is a gauge. It's a gauge thing, right? A gauge artifact. So it seems to me that if you just look at it this way, at this stage, it looks like that the way we allow torsion to accommodate an inconstant lambda, well, I was gonna say incontinent accidentally, it's your fault. This was so general, so I made the thing consistent with the Bianchi identities, but I made it consistent with any varying lambda, okay? So it's not surprising that in the end, I end up with something that doesn't care what the lambda is, but it's not specified by the equations of motion. So I think it's obvious that this is the hallmark of some gauge degree of freedom, and the rest of the talk is trying to identify this, to try and break it, see what's going on. So we expect a varying lambda to be a pure gauge in this theory, but the big question is what is the underlying symmetry, which I've introduced here, which somehow lambda is acting as a gauge mode. Can I break it with pure gravity so that I can actually see a varying lambda which is not pure gauge? And also what happens if matter is added on? Because remember, I did this argument without matter added on, so matter could easily change these. And it would be nice to understand what matter does to this underlying symmetry, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So in a way, this is what immediately you could have asked these questions, even, you know, without the rest of the talk. Okay, so lambda is called cosmological for a good reason, as I said, and typically it's because it only is only felt at the level of cosmology. So you need to go to large-scale structure, fluctuations, zero-order model, something like that, if you want to actually probe the effects of lambda. So let's specialize this theory to homogeneous and isotropic models. And another giveaway for what's coming, let's assume parity invariance as well, okay? So it's kind of a funny thing. You might think that homogeneity in isotropy implies parity invariance. It doesn't, and we got caught in this. And that's the second part of the talk, but let's assume to begin with that parity invariance is part of Copernican's principle, which it isn't. But let's assume that. Okay, so this is where the tragedy starts. This is the ansatz you usually postulate for Friedman, Robertson, Walker. This is cosmological time. This is the expansion factor. This is all the tetrads you can have with homogeneity and isotropy. So this thing is just this function is just a function of time, not space. it's homogeneity. If you allow for torsion, then this is all you can have. So normally, this connection is just the Hubble, H dot over A. If I have torsion, it could be a T here, which appears indeed in the torsion expression. And these are the equations. So the field equations I gave you before, if I have this reduction, homogeneity, isotropy, parity, reduce, and you end up with these things here. So this actually already has the matter. Can you see the lambda square equals lambda square is in a way lifted. This is the degeneracy. If I introduce matter, the expression for T also couples to matter. So it's slightly different. Okay, so what happens? Another thing, so before I move on to what happens, so something which was quite strange is what happens to energy conservation. So there is a very strong constraint in cosmology, which is the continuity equation, which is this one here. This is usually the result of combining the first and the second Friedmann equation. So this is the first, or the Friedmann equation, the Rey-Chaudhuri equation. Typically, you dot this one, you compare, you obtain some kind of continuity equation. It's a mess of a calculation here, but yes, we can actually do that. And we find this funny result that matter is still covariantly conserved with respect to the torsion-free connection. So this was a nightmare of a calculation. This can actually be proved in general using Noether's theorem. It's going to be relevant later on because the equations are going to become worse and worse. And in fact, there is a general proof that under some conditions, you can prove anything as long as the conditions are right, by the way. So that's what theorems are for. But in this case, the conditions are indeed satisfied by a perfect fluid. So for any perfect fluid, this is true, whatever the theory of gravity. So minimally coupled matter always has a covariant conserved equation with respect to a connection which is actually torsion-free. So anyway, this is what happens. Here it is, the equations, a complete set, which is more user-friendly. This is your Friedmann equation with a funny term there. This is your usual equation, and we have these two guys here. So you find some old friends, but now you find something quite funny. Instead of lambda square equals lambda square, without matter, I get something which is exactly proportional, lambda proportional to rho, for a fixed equation of state. So this is the cosmology. Initially, we're very interested in these. It looks like super quintessence. So it's quintessence without free parameters. Great. And in addition, you get what's called a scaling solution, a solution in which lambda, instead of dominating the universe, scales with the background. The background dilutes, and lambda dilutes with the background. But this is not an attractor of a set of differential equations here. It's an algebraic condition. So, you know, this was quite cool. And this is very similar, by the way, to the Cascaton field here, this point. So it looks like there's something which is gauged, non-dynamical, but if there is matter, it just latches onto it. And it's interesting because basically what the general lambda equation is this thing. Remember, this is the Euler term. So if you vary with respect to lambda, you get something like the Euler term related to lambda square. In Riemann, in Friedmann, there's no Weyl tensor, usually. So it's all Ricci curvature. Ricci curvature is the matter by the Einstein equation, so it's not surprising that you get this constraint in this kind of theory. So very nice until you realize you put the numbers in, and this is what happens, complete cataclysm. And particularly if the equation of state is that of radiation, then the scaling is there, but except that rho is zero. So in the radiation epoch, there's no radiation. And say it again?
Can you show it in the equation?
Yeah.
But you could say it's never exactly one third.
Yeah, it doesn't work. We tried everything you can think of. Read the paper. We did our best, okay?
It's not so much that rho is zero, but more that lambda is infinite.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once you substitute in a rho, so.
So you thought.
Yeah. But let's say it's not exactly one term.
Yes, we've done.
So
yeah,
then what
happens? If then it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's a pain. No, exactly. Of course, there are all these things. Eventually, it'll be all radiation, right? But only when you go through all the mass thresholds. So there's going to be a mix. There's actually a divergent dust component there, and this could have. I mean, I could have gone through this. Well, I'm sure you can think of something, you know. This is the first part of the talk as well, and this is kind of, yeah, if you want to finish, we go away. Go earlier.
No, but just,
if anyone has an idea, by the way.
But it's not clear to me what you mean by it doesn't work, because, I mean, in physics, our goal is to compare with observations. So exactly what doesn't work? So,
well, there's no radiation epoch. I mean, this is the most.
No,
it's the CMB, Big Bang Nucleosynthesis, you name it. It's completely screwed.
But that's only for W is not exactly one third. You could say it's a little bit away from one third.
And it doesn't. It doesn't. We're
so
trying.
What happens if you say W is one third?
It's in the paper. I can't remember. It's just a disaster.
See, we tried exactly not one third.
No. We tried matter and radiation mix. And therefore, when you go into the radiation epoch, there is matter. And the matter is divergent, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't work. It's, I forgot. I mean, I can go and look at that.
The one goes dominant was 1/8 of 5 in this combined matter. Now the dominant is over 1/8 over matter or radiation. That's all equal. But the question is the evolution history different from radiation? I guess it's really, yes, you'll see what happens. It's a complete pain in the ass. I mean, basically what happens even in the matter epoch, where it does dominate, you renormalize the gravitational constant because
I was going to tell you this. It's not fine. You violate the variations in G, which are. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a complete disaster. And in a way, it serves us right. I mean, who told you to pick up a theory with fewer parameters than general relativity? It serves you right. Now we cannot fit the data, right? So, you know, it's the revenge.
If you're right that it's worth it to investigate, you know, just go over and over, because it's got one less parameter than GI.
That's true. I mean, I think just saying that it looks different, it shouldn't be right.
It's obvious there is a cataclysm eventually, because eventually everything is radiation, and then there's no radiation, right? So it is, or rather, as Andrew put it, lambda will be infinite, right, compared to.
No, but just because you deviate from a standard picture doesn't mean that you violate observations. I think that's a more clear question. You have to pose a clear question for observations, not just the picture.
Is Big Bang Nucleosynthesis an observation or
not? No, it's not.
Come on.
Oh, okay. Oh,
shut up. Well, you told me to grab it.
My favorite comment is the one person in this collaboration who is not a cosmologist. I was impressed that this was one point in the cosmologist in Rita.
That there was no, there's no BBN? We all agree that there's BBN.
No, that there's a problem with radiation.
Oh, you were impressed?
I mean, in a way, this is very similar to the steady state universe. It's very similar in that respect. It never heats up.
Okay.
It's very similar, and there's the same problems. And of course, there are ways around. You could say maybe all the nucleosynthesis is happening inside the stars.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm just thinking W is never exactly one third.
No, sure. But
it's not even matter, right? It's QCD based transition.
Yeah. We check that. We're very careful with that stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you open the other the equation one before for
lambda? Sure. Oops, that was a nice.
For RP, the first equation, I'll be very naive here, but it looks to me like if we go from matter domination back in time to radiation domination without actually taking the full limit, we create a
moduli. Yeah.
A moduli big, which sounds like inflation.
Moduli. We look at the inflation as well. So, but are you saying zero moduli, things going dust before radiation?
I mean, when W approach of one third from below, lambda increases abundantly, and it will maybe make an exponentially growth phase before the radiation domination.
One of the things we try to do is the effect on inflation as well. Yeah, there is an effect, of course. I mean, you can see it. It basically divides.
Maybe this can be a mechanism for
it. And then what to do with radiation afterwards? I mean, the problem remains.
It's not going to be perfectly one-third radiation, but it will still be between.
No, but then you must have a radiation-dominated epoch, and you have this problem.
Can be arbitrarily close to that.
I mean, I would love for this to be true. As far as we check, it isn't true.
But it's moved.
So you're saying first, so we, because we did do inflation, and we didn't do inflation going into reheating and then radiation, right? Which is what you're saying, if I understand it right. Right? Is it what you're saying?
Excuse me?
I think he's saying start the universe with lambda
infinite. Yeah.
Right, and where do you get the radiation?
Maybe you don't have to radiate.
So first of all, the lambda there doesn't accelerate. The lambda then is gauge.
This is the problem, that this lambda is not what you plug into.
No,
this
is not the lambda which you put. Okay, that's it. So let me just show you one more thing, because in a way the killer is, if you don't like, you could try and play with these things. Okay, smell a rat. You're absolutely right. So it turns out all the terms in the Friedman equation scale. And it turns out you can actually, the proportionality constant is the thing which changes, right, in the matter epoch. And the thing you find is that effectively this is equivalent to renormalizing the gravitational coupling with this formula. And this blows up to infinity, blah, blah, blah. But even in the matter epoch, this is too big. And no, this is not just the fact that there is scaling between rho and lambda, but the T itself is there.
You cannot say it's too big because you only have an FRW, so you have to actually look at big gravity limit and see like what solar system, what Cavendish experiments they would see for G.
But
then those two are inconsistent.
Yeah, I looked at, that's a good point. So you'd have to do everything. But this sounds so much like the steady state, which is a kind of complicated thing. You have to do everything from scratch. I mean, maybe this works. Maybe this works.
Right?
We tried. We failed. Maybe you'll succeed. You know, good for you. I'm cool about that. You know? We tried, and we tried many different things. And in fact, what happens is quite, it's a big difference, isn't it? At some point, I thought this was going to work. Maria, you found something which was a disaster, like a change. What happens to G? G actually acts as if it's bigger or smaller in the matter epoch. There was some kind of disaster at some point. Because of the torsion is it?
You cannot say that until you actually do the big gravity, like solar system thing, and tell. Because you don't, the only G here you have is the cosmological G. And then you don't know.
That's right. Well, that is true. That is true. So feel free to go and do everything starting from a point like this, which is, I mean, I wouldn't want to do that, but you know.
Maybe you should.
Okay. Anyway, this is where the story was until some interesting things. So yes, another rat, blah, blah, blah. I was actually quite surprised by this, by what follows, which is, this is not the complete theory. And particularly, I think we fell into this trap of assuming that the Copernican principle implied parity invariance. The Copernican principle tells you that you have the same thing everywhere in every direction, homogeneity and isotropy. And the question is, well, how does it interact with changing, the mirror symmetry, parity symmetry? So it would be very funny if the universe did never right-handed or left-handed. I found out even cats have got a right-hand, left-hand symmetry, and whales. So why not the universe? And the reason is that in the usual theory, you don't have enough degrees of freedom to put it together, but here we do. So this is an exercise you can play with just about everything, just using symmetry. So let me use the language we've been using, this language of forms, tetrads, and blah, blah, blah. If you have a set of three forms with one label, which is what the stress energy tensor is here, there's no way to produce something which is homogeneous and isotropic other than the perfect fluid. So you cannot break parity at the level of matter. Same thing with the metric, which is why we never see these things in theories which only have a metric. If you have a set of one forms with one label, also there's nothing I can do except the thing I wrote in that ansatz, which only has the expansion factor as a degree of freedom. Now, what is fun is that if I have a theory in which I have a connection and a torsion, degrees of freedom, I can actually violate parity. So specifically, if I have any kind of one forms with two labels, or two forms with one label, which is what the connection and torsion is, you can add these guys, or just playing with Kronecker deltas and epsilons to create an isotropic combinations, you end up with things which violate parity at the level of torsion and connection. So this was a bit surprising. And you know, then once I started this, I started wondering about other things. So let's play this game. So this is some cosmologists here. So for example, the CMB. Could I have a CMB which is isotropic and parity invariant? And so purely on grounds of symmetry, I can only have a monopole. Because if I have something which is a multipole, it prefers a direction, right? If I have a monopole in the temperature, there's no way I can break parity because it's just a scalar, it's just a number, 2.7 Kelvin. Can't do anything. But for example, polarization. Can I do this with polarization? So linear polarization, no, because linear polarization must pick a direction in which you linearly polarize. So you would actually violate, even if you had a monopole, you would actually violate isotropy with linear polarization. But with circle polarization, no. You can actually have the same circle polarization in any direction. And this would break parity because I could have right and left polarization. So I can actually have a CMB, which is isotropic, monopole, and parity violating. So one thing I looked at initially was the B mode. B mode breaks parity. But that there is no such thing as a B mode monopole, as far as I can see. But you can have a V mode polarization, which is a monopole. So play these games as you want. It was a very surprising thing for me that you could actually have Friedman models with parity violation. As usual, once you find them, you discover that someone found this before you. In fact, in 1922, Cartan, which is why this talk is called the Cartan spiral staircase, Cartan found this thing, which was the most general space, Euclidean space in three dimensions, which violated parity. That's exactly what distortion is. So funnily enough, there is actually quite a lot of use of these, the tools we're using here, what I'm about to say, in the gauge theory of these locations. And all Cartan did was, let's look at the most general flat space in three dimensions. Let's look at their four connections, which are flat, but have torsion. And if you parallel transport in any direction, any vector which is orthogonal, they just rotate. And they can rotate in one direction or the other. So there you are, you violate parity. It's a very interesting geometrical interpretation. It's the spiral staircase, Cartan spiral staircase. If you continue using the geometrical interpretations of torsion, like the failure of these parallel transports to close, it's exactly what we have. So the thing I propose is nothing but 1922 Cartan construction, but in a Friedman model. So very interesting, what happens now? So the equations are the same, the general equations. The question is, when I reduce them to Friedman, what do I get? Let's see. And this is really quite a strange thing. So everything changes dramatically. But basically, the same equation.
Can I ask?
Yeah?
Is that, can I try to interpret that as any polarized object, if I look at this rotation, and there would be a parallel rotation?
No. There was an example. This doesn't happen in this theory, right? So that's an example of the electromagnetism, right?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to look at. So this is what happens. This parallel transport here is an abstract parallel transport. So take any.
If I had polarized light, it would probably be the same thing. Like,
what did I say 5 minutes ago? Yeah.
It's another thing.
No, this doesn't happen in the minimal theory because the matter fall is covariantly conserved with respect to the torsion free connection. So actually, usually matter doesn't feel the torsion. So unfortunately, the example I gave, which is an abstract example,
okay,
is incapable of, unless I do non-minimal coupling, I don't have this. It's a pity because, I mean, this would be a nice signature of this.
But it's up to you how you want to couple in that sense.
Yeah, sure. But the constraint you're going to get is always going to be a constraint between what I'm about to say and the non-minimal coupling parameter. And I don't like free parameters. So. Yeah, there you are. Okay, so this is we're actually stuck on this point, and you're probably going to find this quite funnily. so you see that's going to be quite different. The culprit, the novelty here is this equation. So, I mean, of course, when I have symmetry, like Einstein symmetry, a lot of the equations are 0 equals 0 because of the symmetry. You don't write all the Einstein equations because a bunch of them are 0 equals 0 in Schwarzschild and whatever. So. And here what happens is that this 0 equals 0 I didn't write here is actually this equation where P is my new term in the torsion. And if P equals 0, this is just 0 equals 0. But if P is not 0, this is a differential equation. So first thing, you get one more extra differential equation if I allow for parity violation. And then second, the thing which is an algebraic constraint usually becomes a differential equation because the left-hand side, this thing which is usually 0, is actually a differential equation in P.
Where is G here?
Sorry?
Where is G?
What G?
G find up in the top left. It was G, J squared.
Oh, yeah. It's defined here, right? So this is
right.
So it's this A dot over A plus T, right? And this is the torsion.
On the right hand side already.
So yeah, oh, this, this, yeah, it's defined. It's defined there. I defined it before. Okay, already.
You know.
I mean, I'm not expecting to remember every single.
And P is.
P is the new term. Is the new is the spiral staircase. It's the parity violating term in the torsion.
It's a parameter in your connection.
Yeah. No, it's not the parameter. It's the field.
It's,
right?
A function.
It's a function. It's a function of time.
Okay, but it appears as a parameterization of your connection, or it's.
It's this guy here. So the omega ij, which is usually zero, contains the p. Yeah. So I will be using these guys. So remember, the p, as the name indicates, is a parity violating guy. Okay. Okay. So what's happening here? Well, I think this happens essentially because of another surprise. And again, I was very surprised by this. Why is it that suddenly matter is not constrained, matter and lambda are not algebraically constrained. So remember, I told you that this thing, the reason is because the Euler term can be related to matter, because I only have Ricci curvature in Friedman. So as it turns out, this breaks down as well. I don't know if you knew this, I didn't, certainly didn't know this. But if you violate parity, you can actually have vile tensor in a Friedman mode, which is very surprising. I've never seen this before, apparently. Yeah, the theorem which tells you that the Friedman model cannot have vile curvature is only true if I don't have torsion. And in fact, the torsion you need to have is parity violating torsion. So it's really quite a different theory. And it's going to be interesting to now ask the question, how do these two branches relate? Because they're quite different. They have different differential equations. As we find out, they're going to have different degrees of freedom. So this is just a question of language, and quite frankly, I don't care what language we use. Are these two separate branches of the same theory, two separate theories? Are they the same theory but in different phases? I don't know about you when I don't know what I'm doing, because this just shows I don't know what I'm doing. I do a calculation, not a random calculation. In this case, the thing which I think is going to sharpen an understanding of what is going on here is the Hamiltonian analysis. And using the Dirac method for computing degrees of freedom, these things, they have different degrees of freedom. And it's going to be really quite a different story. Yeah?
So which two things are you referring to? I must have missed that.
It's this. So,
parity violating.
As I said, whether you set parity violating things to zero in a Friedman model or not, you end up with a completely different set of equations with different differential equations, different number of degrees of freedom, etc.
So you mean that one is not just the other with p equal to zero?
Well, you see, if p is zero, this equation disappears because it means just zero equals zero. If p is not zero, it tells you this guy has got to be one. Completely different. This is the thing which gave us trouble before, an algebraic constraint. This thing is actually sourced by a differential equation. So they look like different systems, right?
Is something going to stop p evolving through zero?
It doesn't get stuck at zero. I had this same question initially. So they don't overlap. They're really different branches. You don't go. Initially, I thought peace and love, we're all mates. I thought our paper's going to be an attractor for these other ones.
Right.
They're different theories. They are different theories. There's no doubt they never talk to each other. They're completely different theories. Can I continue? Because it's going to be revealing, and Lee's about to fall asleep, and I want you to wake up, be awake the next one. Because you might actually.
Maybe if I could just ask a small question. How would you measure parity that is defined in this way to have a reason to expect it to be non-zero?
Say it again, I didn't hear.
So if we would really expect this non-parity cosmological principle to hold on large scales in the universe, how would we measure?
Well, the thing which I would love it to be measured is what Niash just said, polarization. A monopole in circle polarization would be just complete proof there is parity violation in the universe, end of the story, isotropic. And practice is more subtle. If I don't want to give up minimal coupling, then it's going to be more subtle. You kind of would see it in the Friedman equation. So everything I said before, but the other theory I'm going to say now about this one, and it's going to be a different story.
Okay.
Okay, so let's see this now. So I'm not terribly good with this. In fact, I learned all this stuff about Dirac things from a course Lee gave in quantum gravity when I was here for 2 years. And it's basically why I learned all this stuff. But it's basically the trick of trying to find the constraints, the algebras of constraints, how many are first class, how many are second class, and keep doing it until it closes. It's not that difficult, really, but it's just essentially to deal with constraints as if you have an algebra generated by the Poisson bracket algebra. So here, this is quite interesting. So yes, you're a bit like G's and P's and so on. It turns out it's easier to transform my P's and G's into moving coordinates before I do the Hamiltonian analysis, which is usually quite complicated. So this is a common trick. You end up with something like this. And if you reorganize things a little bit, you will probably not be surprised to find that this is equivalent to saying, after an integration by parts, that I have a lambda, which is now a variable, which has a conjugate momentum, which is forced to be something called the Chern-Simons time. So this is where we started from in the quantum theory. And I might not have time to go there. We were trying to play with Heisenberg principles between lambda and time to screw up the timeline of the universe. There's a measure of time which Lee proposed with Chopinsu, I suppose, in the...
You mean pi is equal to tau.
Say it again?
You mean pi is equal to tau.
You mean what?
Pi. The pi.
Pi
is equal to tau.
Or proportional. Yeah, proportional. Exactly. And this guy here is nothing but the imaginary part of the Chern-Simons integral, but with this particular. Okay. So you can rephrase this thing as if, you know, this is my usual Hamiltonian constraint, which appears in any kind of theory when I reduce to FRW. And now I have a different constraint with a different Lagrange multiplier, V, which forces the conjugate momentum of lambda, or lambda minus 1, to be the Chern-Simons. So this is the first thing you find in the Hamiltonian formulation. The second one, you find that my parity violating field is not dynamical. I was a bit confused here what to do about this. What I did was what I was told in the classroom, thank you very much, 2006 or something, which is if you can, in a situation like that, use a solve the equation. But if you don't have a conjugate momentum, the C doesn't look dynamical, just solve it. So you know, we did things in two different ways, but if you do it that way, so the C is like the moving P, you end up with something which has the same property of C times something equals C times something. If C equals 0, 0 equals 0, there's nothing special. If C is not 0, you can see what happens is that you constrain the Lagrange multiplier for this new constraint, and that's for the Hamiltonian constraint. So somehow, by switching on the parity violation, what looks like two constraints become one constraint, because now I can eliminate the Lagrange multipliers with respect to the other one. So I think that this is really two for the price of one. You wrote one Lagrangian, everything looked very simple in one theory. But now somehow these two branches reflect the fact I can actually write theory one and theory two, which are really quite different in terms of number of constraints, whether I allow for parity violation or not allow for parity violation. So in one case, this guy here constrains the two Lagrange multipliers, so I only have one constraint, which is a combination of the two. In the other, they're independent. And then you can compute, as I was told to do, the Poisson bracket, it closes to the first class constraint. Okay? So this is interesting because, as Dirac told us, you can compute the number of degrees of freedom of a theory just by looking at the phase space and the number of first class and the number of second class constraints. So really, I think I have different theories here. Remember, GR with no matter in this approximation is 0 degrees of freedom, just the sitter on anti-de sitter. There's nothing I can do, okay? If I have theory one, in which there's parity violations, I only have one first class constraint. So I have two, basically I double the phase space by having these lambda and pi, I have one first class constraint, I have 1 degree of freedom. In the theory two, on the other hand, I have two constraints, so I ended up, I double up the phase space. So by promoting lambda to a variable and having a pi, I have four, the dimension of space space is four, but I have another constraint, so I do nothing but what I had before in terms of GR. Is this clear? So it looks like these two things. No, it's not clear. This is counting. This is 4 minus 2.
It's
Okay, let me go back. So remember this bit here? I can have C equals 0 or C not different, C different from 0.
So C equals 0 is the theory 2 or theory 1?
So C equals 0 is the theory 2.
So, theory two.
So it's the theory I told you about in the beginning
first,
of the.
The first one has no degree of freedom.
No, this the yeah, it doesn't have because basically you introduce two new variables, which is the lambda and the pi, but you have another constraint, not a first class constraint.
So the
thing I've been saying that the varying lambda we found was pure gauge, is basically this statement. It looks like I have more degrees of freedom, but no degrees of freedom.
Okay, so there's none.
Yeah.
But the theory one has one degree of freedom, right? That's what.
Yes, because if C is not zero, then this thing relates to the two Lagrange multipliers, so I still have just one constraint. So I start from GR, space dimension 2, one constraint. Now I have lambda and pi, so 4, but I still have just one constraint. So I have one genuine new degree of freedom in this two. Do you agree with this? Or not?
Okay, he doesn't want to come with
you. No. It sounds possible.
Sounds fun. It's because you didn't do the calculation. It wasn't fun. With matter is a pain, at least.
I'm sure.
With matter, you get second-class constraints. It's the same story, but it's a mess.
So in the full theory, do you have this dichotomy too?
Yeah. We haven't done the full. You mean the graviton and everything?
Yeah, if you don't just symmetry reduce.
Yeah.
You do?
I know. Well, you still split. Basically, this is like the vacuum around which you're going to now perturb, right? So the question is, how do you see the graviton? Mm-hmm. It's even worse. So this thing actually doesn't have the Minkowski space-time solution.
So your flat space solution is this Cartan?
Yeah. You can see it here. If you set to zero, rho, lambda, everything, this is zero. Mm-hmm. And you get P goes like 1 over A. So you go up here, there, the G square, which is that guy there. It's like, so you end up with the Milne universe, A proportional to T, and P proportional to 1 over T. This is the closest we have to Minkowski space-time. So it's the Cartan. It's the Cartan spiral staircase with an intensity that decreases like 1 over t with the cosmological time.
A is proportional to t, and then?
And p is proportional to 1 over a. Right? So it's a funny thing to do, right? I mean, I think.
So what is that geometry?
It's a distortion. So it's basically, it's something, it's flat but with a torsion. Yeah.
Did you say A is proportional to T?
Yeah.
Do you have curvature here?
No. So it is this guy there. So yeah, you can have reach. So one thing is, you're asking all the right questions, and as a result, I'm not going to get to the end. So it's actually not true. I mean, it's true that I need parity violation to have vial tensor, but the parity guy also appears in the reach.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. I see.
So it's slightly, yeah.
It's just flat. Okay.
Right, right.
Okay.
But it's very similar to Milne with k equals minus 1, which is indeed
right.
Richie.
There is a k here, yeah. Instead, I guess. So your p is kind of like k.
It's a funny thing. It's a bit like curvature in some ways. Yeah. It behaves dynamically like curvature, which isn't like curvature. Okay, let me just move on a bit and maybe. So that you can understand what this is. So this is just counting. And then the question is clearly, okay, so what happens? What is the meaning of a varying lambda in theory two? Theory two is a parity, is one in which doesn't have any new degrees of freedom. So I think the extra constraint present in theory two must represent some gauge transformation, as I've been guessing right from the start. The fact that actually it doesn't, is not fixed by the equations of motion. It's also true that the time evolution can be seen as a Hamiltonian evolution plus a gauge transformation, which is typically what happens when I have these gauge degrees of freedom. So the big question is, what is the gauge symmetry associated with this? And I think we found it simply by looking at the action of these constraints on the various variables, and then you go to the full theory. It's actually conformal invariant. And it's a funny thing, because it's not conformal invariant. Conformal is a big word, and I realize some people call it vial, some people call it whatever. But this is a variation to conformal with quotation marks. It's a conformal invariance, which you change the metric. But remember, I have a theory torsion. I don't change the connection. So the torsion absorbs completely the variations in the metric. And then you change the cosmological constant. So the cosmological constant is gauge with respect to conformal invariances. And if you go to our action here, you can either see it from here or from there, you see that the action is not exactly conformally invariant, but it's a density, it's a conformal density with weight one. Okay? So I think this explains, in a way, the various things we found in what is now called theory two, the parity invariant one. Lambda can be seen as a gauge mode associated with conformal invariance, defined in this way. So you could, in fact, find a conformal frame in which lambda is a constant, okay, which is the reason why somehow you change the gravitational constant, because the whole thing factors this weight. And that's the reason why, if I have conformal matter, like radiation, nothing changes. I'm just in vacuum, I'm a gauge mode. If I have non-conformal matter, I have something which is like a varying G. What is this factor which comes out? Why do I break the gauge symmetry if I break parity? Well, that's just to do with the fact that because my action is not exactly invariant, it's just proportional to something, so it's multiplied by this extra factor, every time I have to do an integration by parts, the equations of motion are not going to be invariant because I'm going to pick up that factor. So where do I integrate by parts in the Palatini formulation? It's when I find the connection equation, which gives me the torsion. So I don't quite understand why this is the case, but at least by just doing the math, you conclude that the thing which is invariant, which is non-invariant at the level of the equations of motion, is exactly the component of the torsion that violates parity. So the other one doesn't. You can see the torsion comes in this funny way, but this is the equation, and the equation preserves this transformation with the P, it doesn't. So it's kind of a funny thing. I'm not quite sure if I understand this completely. But it looks like that basically we have proposed, the thing we have done, which looked like so fun, so much fun, and so parameter-free, is nothing but imposing some kind of conformal invariance into general relativity related to lambda, right? And this thing doesn't actually do anything. If you add matter as well, you find the same thing, except I have second-class constraints. You find exactly the same story. So if I have matter, I increase the phase space in GR by 2. Constraint is still the Hamiltonian constraint. I have 1 degree of freedom. If I have a theory like the one with conformal invariance, well, I had 0 without matter. Now I still have 1 degree of freedom. If I have non-conformal matter, if I add radiation, which is conformally invariant, I'm back to the same situation, it's as if I have general relativity without any matter. So, you know, it's a more complicated thing. The algebra, the analysis of the Hamiltonian degrees of freedom here are really quite complicated. But basically, this just reinforces the same thing. Only by breaking parity and conformal invariance, we have a new degree of freedom. Otherwise, lambda, you have a varying lambda, but it's a gauge degree of freedom in vacuum or with radiation. And with non-conformal matter, is just a slave degree of freedom, a lacus caton, if you want. OK, now we have three things. Well, meanwhile, I ran out of time, I can imagine. What's the time?
Yeah, 4 or 5 minutes.
4 or 5 minutes. OK. What am I going to tell you? OK, I'm not going to tell you anything. I'm going to open it. Go on.
So it seems like, in theory, I think you called it one which, two that have parity, that doesn't allow parity. We have this equation, lambda square with other terms that constrains everything. That equation seems very unstable, that it can even fall with a bit of parity violation. So it would, no. I would expect it to fall if we add some inhomogeneity. So it looks like an exceptional case of a broader theory that is more like theory one with matter.
They don't talk to each other at a zero level. So this was the question Andrew asked earlier on. And you might think, do they jump from one branch to another branch? They don't. The different degrees of freedom are different. So I would be very surprised if I perturbed and I got something.
It just is an exceptional case with Lebesgue measure view or something, I don't know. But like a very exception that is not stable, that's what I mean. That if we were in the exceptional If we didn't have pure FRW, but if we had some resulting homogeneity,
we have studied that. Yes, yes.
Anything, then we wouldn't expect it.
So that theory, I think, has nothing but relativity. It's going to have a graviton just like the other graviton, because I can have Minkowski spacetime just like the other one. So I think it's the other theory, the parity-violating one, which does not even have a Minkowski spacetime to start from. That's going to have a different graviton structure. They don't talk to each other, don't worry. It's the fact that this is like zero for order. It's different branches, it's different degrees of freedom. You started with different theories already at the zeroth level. It's not going to be the fluctuations that are going to make them the same. Right? I think it's, okay, let me just, so I had several things. Let me just kind of go through this quite quickly. So first of all, okay, just 2 minutes of just kind of going through the main points. One thing we avoided was the Pontryagin theorem, because it's zero. Turns out the Pontryagin theorem is not zero if I have parity violation. So this is parameterized by the Mirzi parameter. So it turns out that if I have a Pontryagin term in a universe which is Friedman, but which violates parity, it does appear in the Friedman equations. Why is this important? Yes, because it can actually produce a universe like the one we see. Okay? There is a matter epoch, a radiation epoch, and an accelerating epoch later on. But I need to do not just violate parity, but introduce this other topological invariant called the Pontryagin invariant.
So how many new free parameters do you have?
Just, well, in fact, I have the same as general relativity.
But you have this extra dynamical.
Yes, and it depends on the initial conditions.
So is it just...
So we're doing, unfortunately, this is not a scaling solution. It cannot be, right? It's obvious.
So it's just one extra parameter for this, so the initial condition is at one parameter or two parameters?
No, hold on a bit. So I have the Mirzi parameter, which controls the that's just one, but I don't have lambda.
Right.
So this has the same number of parameters as GR. And then the problem is that this depends on the initial condition, because it's not the scalar.
So that's also a free parameter.
Yeah.
Is that just P and P dot, or just P
U? It's P zero and P zero dot. And we're doing MCMCs to see how general this is, and it's kind of not easy.
So you don't have two extra parameters.
Yeah.
Three extra.
Well, as initial conditions. So not as Lagrangian. Oh, come on, but it's different. So this is one thing I wanted to say before leaving you. The other one is this thing, which is just a speculation. Tuft wrote this paper saying that you can regulate all the problems in quantum gravity if you allow for these conformal invariants to be added on at a fundamental level. This is something I don't quite understand, except he's got the first prize in the Gravity Foundation essay, in which I got the second one with this group of friends. No bitterness in here. But we found the same thing looking at cosmological perturbation theory.
So the first prize. Everything has conformal symmetry, the second one said it's broken.
No, the second one is saying that if you also postulate conformal symmetry, like in Ojava Leaf. Yeah, but that's the point. You switch off gravity earlier on. It's the same story, basically. So you take something like the Ojava Lifshitz, the type things, gravity switches off conformal invariance, and you find that the fluctuations are actually scaling invariant. I don't know how they relate. I don't even understand Tuft's paper very much. I like to think I understand this one. But maybe I don't. Now, I think what I said today, and I think I'll finish here, is that it looks like that I'm just adding on another piece of the puzzle here. So it appears that conformal invariants, whatever Tuft suggested and whatever we suggested, can also be a piece of the puzzle about what is lambda doing, the cosmological constant problem. But it looks like that essentially the cosmological constant could be like a gauge field for conformal invariants, or at least a gauge mode, right? And it could be that you need to break parity to actually break these invariants, which is what we find in the concrete example of a Friedman model. You're doing that. So this is all very tied to the inner works of the torsion here, but I think this could be more general. And I have another half an hour of talk, but I stop here. Thank you.
You started your talk by playing around with the torsion, but have you trained also to play around instead with the non-metricity?
No, I didn't think about that.
Okay.
So no metricity, yes. So this is just standard first order formalism. I mean, I didn't invent any of these things.
Yeah.
So it's just basically taking a connection, taking a metric, a tetrad, and just getting along with it. This is not very much beyond the usual Palatine.
Yeah. It all stems somehow from this duality symmetry principle you're postulating that impose these constraints. So can you say a bit more about, because it's true that anytime you have duality symmetry, you always have a constraint f which f equal f tilde which f tilde.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of algebraic constraint. So here you say a bit more about this duality symmetry.
I can't say that it is broken.
So
one of the things, so you mean by the self-dual condition? Or the
yeah, you want to exchange
r
with the wedge product.
So one thing which is funny, we were looking at some stage when we started, for solution, vacuum solutions which were not self-dual. This is them. In fact, we have them. So if you just go there, you put the P there, and you solve everything, you end up with vacuum solutions, just lambda, nothing else, which are actually not self-dual. So they do exist, right? And I think by breaking conformal invariance and parity, you also break the self-dual condition.
But you could also demand, let's say, the matter coupling to respect that symmetry.
I had a lot of discussions, with Kirill Krasnov about this.
For massive field, it's broken, but for massless fields, which are your problem, massless fields couples to sigma, to E with G.
Yeah.
So you could just couple it to E with G minus R.
In the end, I got very confused by that. Because it looks like a radiation epoch is an epoch in which the field strength is proportional to the sigma bar. So it's like anti-self-dual. Whereas the lambda epoch is something in which F is proportional to sigma, so it's self-dual. So in fact, the coupling, which is actually the most relevant one in the beginning of the universe, is anti-self-dual. Whereas the one in which you're headed to is self-dual.
What I'm saying is that you chose a coupling which is usually E with G is the usual coupling. So
I didn't choose any coupling.
For massless series, you can couple directly the theory to your two form field, E with G, right?
You couple it, okay. The matter coupling, because in this context,
the matter coupling is simply to
the metric, right?
Well, for massive field, for scalars, yes, but for spin one, for instance, no, for ideas.
Yes. There's no spinners here. It's very important. I get torsion, I get...
Maxwell field coupled to gravity just using D?
E with G.
Right.
So you could have a Maxwell coupling,
which doesn't break
the symmetry.
Right.
Right.
But in a way, the Maxwell field is one that doesn't matter because it's conformally invariant. You need to break conformally.
No, for the first part of your story. I mean, you're postulating a fundamental symmetry and then you break it in the radiation. What I'm saying is that there may be, if you really believe this is a new fundamental duality symmetry, then maybe trying to maintain it in the matter coupling, is a very important thing to do. But sooner or later,
you're going to need to go beyond that. I mean, I talked to Kirill a lot about that because, I mean, so the question is, normally you need the metric, so you need this horrible Urbanski thing to actually find an expression for the metric. And couple it directly.
You need to go beyond that, but for the so it's going to be the fermion that breaks it. But any gauge coupling does not have to break your symmetry, your duality symmetry.
Right.
So if you take the standard model, it's in some sense you can the symmetry breaking could just be due to matter, not to radiation.
I know, but I didn't like that. I really didn't like that in the end because I think. The basic problem is to do cosmology, you never have that degree of freedom. I mean, homogeneity is an isotropic and this is a perfect fluid. And it's very difficult, as I said earlier on, that stress energy tensor free form, which is like the main thing here, is really awkward to write in the Blavatsky, right? Which is exactly what you're trying to do. I want a free form, I don't want a two form. So I know in the Blavatsky, I know it's slightly different, but...
I know
you normally like to write these things like this. And then you have some kind of tie, which is a two-form, right? Which is like a variation of the matter action with respect to the sigma. So this is kind of not the natural way in which things appear here. I mean, I'm sure it could be translated, right? I got very disillusioned. I talked to Kirill a lot, and I got very disillusioned with that kind of approach because it's just complicating something which is very simple.
I'm not sure if I...
I want the perfect fluid. I want the perfect fluid.
You're saying that I will take your symmetry seriously. I don't know why you demand this duality R sigma, but suppose, you know, I go along with you and I say, okay, well, let's me take it seriously then. I don't know, let's take it, you know, more seriously than you're doing.
You see, I'm not sure the self-duality is actually what I need to take this further.
I don't know why you're demanding that's your model.
I think that's so one thing I thought of doing, which is goes back to that guy there, which is so what happens if you, let me just see this kind of, you want to see the talk. So what happens if you actually look at the parity violating C as an extra constraint? Would you, so you told me you should never do that, but.
We run in some.
Yeah, instead of solving it, let's imagine I say.
It's a second class constraint.
Sorry?
It's a second class.
Second class, yeah. So that's my problem. I was hoping to get some intuition about, this is why I'm saying this now.
You try to keep it as a constraint, and then you run
you go and so you end up you do that and you end up with the same counting for different with different, you know, now the phase space is six dimensional.
Yeah, you share that with the same.
Sorry?
Share that with the same.
Exactly.
Generate.
But the thing I was hoping to do was to say that this extra constraint is generating the symmetry which is behind this funny.
No, because that would be second
class. I know. Yeah.
And the best you can hope for is that in the plasma vector the two of them will be something that you.
So it's a pain because I was hoping to get some intuition from this, but it's second class, so it doesn't need to generate a great transformation. So I don't know if self-dual has got something to say here to this or not.
Yeah, I mean, it does. In some sense, you know, his self-duality is saying that what I'm saying is that EOG is some other ultra-star operator on two form. And when you write bosonic theory, all you need to know is not really the metric, it's the ultra. Therefore, you can make it self-dual. For acting in curvature, and then that's going to drastically change your first conclusion, which relies a lot on how things come to radiation. But
I can't see a perfect fluid being anything other than.
It's going to change the constraints. Like if your duality is extended to the other two forms, then your algebraic constraints are going to contain a component coming from radiation.
That's why you have an EOG. You had an EOG minus lambda.
Yeah. I mean, you're right.
Okay. But we didn't pursue it.
Because the question is, what is the meaning of that symmetry? Should I take it seriously?
It's an interesting direction, and at some point there were many drafts. At some point, the drafts included. Do you remember this? There's an extension of the Einstein, which was explicitly very.
So one thing which is interesting is that, so this is the point. So even if you set matter to zero, you're actually breaking this duality condition in this new branch. So we had speculated whether or not there were non-self-dual lambda solutions, these are them.
But so your parity symmetry breaks that symmetry?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. So I don't need the matter to draw this conclusion. I know it does break it. And we've written the solutions. And you know it had to be because the first one were pure gauge according to conformal invariance. I knew I could do a conformal transformation to absorb that varying lambda, whereas here you can't. So.
It's not your gauge.
Sorry?
Your message is that once you break parity.
Say it again?
Once you break parity.
It's not pure gauge, yeah. But also it's not self-dual.
Yeah, that's good.
That's good, yeah.
Is that good? Then, why do we have self-dual symmetry to start with?
Because it's an axial symmetry.
Yeah, but here you were promoting it as a... I mean, otherwise the third parameter, the R, which R parameter, should be a theta.
It tries to be
connected to lambda.
No.
In your case, theta was 1 over lambda, and that's where you get all the interesting physics. If there's no symmetry principle, your theta parameter doesn't have to be the inverse of the cosmological constant. So the main reason behind, I don't know. I'm trying to be with you. The reason your theta parameter is 1 over lambda is because of the symmetry. The symmetry doesn't matter.
No, but that's a starting point. That's a starting point, and then you get on with it. I mean, that's just to guess the thing, right? I mean, that's a starting point which allows you, this is the problem with motivating things in a way that everyone can understand, is that people overinterpret it later.
Then go
so, for example, so actually, an interesting.
What is your action then?
Yeah, but an interesting action is the following. Okay, wait a bit.
I know what you're going to show, but I think the real lesson is that there are lots of directions to go. There are bifurcation points, there's this one, there are other bifurcation points earlier on.
Is this a bifurcation point, or is it just a different theory? Or different?
Well, that's, I think, very well.
I don't know. It's just
there are a number of different. There's a territory here, and there are a number of different things to explore.
You see, I don't find this principle that interesting, to be honest. You guessed the theory. You guessed the theory.
Yes.
But for example, you would never have guessed that this thing has actually an effect. So this is what actually happened using this game of duality, right? So in general, if I have torsion, the whole stirrum would have to have this dt, right? So this is the Ni-Yan, the Ni-Yan thing. If you apply this stuff, you end up with the Pontryagin. So this guy here never actually does anything, because this guy is properly topological. This one is quasi-topological. This one is properly topological. And what is actually difficult to guess is that until you break parity, this is irrelevant in cosmology. This is zero.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the breaking parity is the most important thing. And you know, in this kind of construction, heuristically, I use the self-duality.
Okay,
but in a way, it's
it means if you want to focus on parity breaking, which is
yeah,
the coefficient for S error doesn't have to be 1 over lambda. It's just theta 1.
The coefficient of what? This guy here.
This guy is just a theta 1.
Which is what we did, right? At some point, we were okay, but that is the only parameter that makes lambda a gauge mode if I don't break the conformal symmetry, which is important, right?
Okay, so
it's not just that. I mean, this is the problem with using heuristics things. People overinterpret them.
I mean,
so you can see, this is just heuristics, because this guy here is a self-dual combination, right? I just take self-dual, and then I play with the epsilons and whatever, and I end up with this construction in which, so this is the two terms we have. This is the generalization of the Holster, the Ni-Yan. And then you end up with the Pontryagin, which is actually tuned by the Mirzi parameter in this case. Which is cool. I think it's quite cool. And then basically you need the, so to cut a long story short, and I hope this is not like numerical. It looks like that this guy has to be order one, and then there's the issue of the initial conditions. And the Ash ran away, he was the one who asked the question.
All right, I guess we can maybe close the
sure.
there and keep going the discussion. Let's thank you.